Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really incredible guest. You know, I'm obviously a little bit biased because he's from Spain, from Madrid. And as you all know, you know, I'm from there. So obviously, very inspiring conversation that we have in front of us. We're going to be talking about bootstrapping, building profitable companies versus going crazy at raising money with growth. We're going to be talking about as well international expansion and how to think about it. Also, culture and team, how to think about mentoring your people versus just getting outsiders. And then lastly, reflection after an exit. Again, really amazing conversation that we have in front of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Pablo Fernandez Alvarez. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro, for having me on the show. It's a big pleasure to be sharing the learnings these years.
So born in Spain, there in Madrid, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up, Pablo?
It was great. So I am the number two of six brothers and sisters, and I've lived like in eight cities in Madrid. So my parents were moving a lot. So I always had like this sense of adventures of taking risk and following your passions with my parents. And I studied international relations as major in the University of Madrid. I was trying to be an entrepreneur, but I failed a couple of times as a student. So I always have this entrepreneurial thing. And I started my career like in a very traditional path with consulting at BCG in the Madrid office. Then I moved to New York in investment banking, working for the largest Spanish bank, Santander. And then I joined the global strategy team, and they appointed me the head of strategy of Santander, the US in Boston, where I spent a few years. In the interim, I did my graduate education at Harvard Business School in Boston.
Before that, Pablo, you know, it's interesting what you mentioned here because, you know, obviously working in Spain, you know, versus working in the U.S. is a little bit different, you know, and I guess my question here is, what was the culture shock or what kind of worldview did it open for you being able to come to the U.S., seeing, you know, how things, the dynamics, how things operated here in the country? So how was that experience for you as well?
Well, I remember the first day I arrived to New York, and I felt the speed in the subway, and people were moving much faster than Madrid. But I was lucky. In Madrid, I was working for an American firm at BCG. We were working like 100 hours per week, so I have that culture of hard working. But what I love about the U.S. is this American dream. I live the American dream myself. Many people in Spain, they don't believe this. In Spain, typically, if you are born poor, you don't scale up, and people hesitate about possibility. But in my case, I lived the American dream, and I for me the big cultural shock was that there was not hierarchy, there was not bureaucracy. It was everything about working hard, and meritocracy, and it really opened up my mind to see other people that were thinking big. No? So it helped me to think bigger than in Spain.
And you did work at BCG, as you alluded to it. You know, you were there for a couple of years. And one of the things that I see with the founders, you know, they have very similar backgrounds in the sense that they either went to consulting, investment banking, private equity, or VC before they decided to pull the trigger on venturing into the unknown. Now, one of the things that I see from consulting is that it gives you the opportunity of being able to break down big problems into smaller problems and then tackling them. So what kind of framework would you say working at BCG gave you to tackle problems?
Well, I guess that's kind of like a traditional answer. But for me, honestly, Alejandro, it's more about work ethics, right? I think, and I invest sometimes in consultants, but for me, it's if you work at one of these places, I know that you can work 100 hours per week during a few years, right? So working very hard, for me, it's very important. Of course, being able to communicate, right? Even if it's bullshit, sometimes as an entrepreneur, you need to sell, you need to convince people. So this first, they help you how to do PowerPoint, good decks, good presentations, how to convince others. And in my case, my co-founder worked at BCG also. So it's a good network thing. So you really find like out of co-founders, I also invested in other people at BCG that were very investments where I multiplied by 100 my investments, like Sergio Furio at Creditas that worked with me at BCG, or Pau Sabri at Olapik. I was investor in them. So it's, for me, it's network, it's work ethics. It's also communication skills. And also in my case, it helped me, it also helps you to go to business schools. So traditionally in Spain, many people that want to go to top business schools in the US, going to consulting health.
So the MBA at Harvard, you know, came at the time, the idea of doing it came at the time where you were at Santander. And in Santander, you held several roles, you know, whether it was in Boston or, you know, the different offices that they had. Now, why did you decide to shift gears and to say, hey, you know, I think it's time for me to maybe take a pause, you know, really go and study, and especially doing an MBA? What was the trigger for that?
Yeah. So I remember it was a professor at Harvard, Tom DeLong. I remember one day he told me, like, okay, what do you have to lose? You are not married. You don't have a mortgage. Worst case scenario is that you start something, and then if it doesn't work, you can always go to do bullshit PowerPoint and get paid $200K per year. So that was like a wake up call. And says, okay, oh, he's right. In the meaning, like, I have nothing to lose. And then it was the regret that I will have in my life. No, so I was in a moment in which, okay, no liabilities, down with experience. And I said, if I don't do this now, when I am 80 years old and laying in my bed and thinking about my life, I will regret not having started the company. So I remember that was, but I delayed it a little bit because after the MBA, they offered me to be head of a strategy of Santander in the US. So obviously I was making a lot of money and progressing. I was part of the board of directors and the executive committee of a 30,000 people company. So It cost me a lot, so I deferred entrepreneurship until I was 34 years old. But at that point, I really took the decision to quit, and it was the inspiration of some of my fellow people at Santander BCG that were starting their companies, and they inspired me to take, you know, to leave my job and start ClickCars. My first.
What was that day like when you finally decided to take action, to give your notice, and to jump off the cliff?
So it was October 15, 2015. So I always remember that day. And the good thing is that when I told this to my boss was the CEO and president of Santander in the US, he said to me, okay, I will invest $500,000 in you. Okay. So they was like, wow, I'm quitting my job. And my boss was investing in me. And many of my bosses, they invested in me. So that was very reassuring that the people that know me were trusting to my new venture.
So how did the how were the early days of ClickCars like?
So I left Santander on October 2015, and I remember arriving to Madrid. And the funny thing was, like, I went to the notary to start the company, and then I wanted to print the deck to talk to some early investors, and then the print place was closed, and it says we come back, and I said, like, okay, I was like, I have like a very cultural shock in coming back to Spain, because I was used to the American speed, the mindset of everything, and, you know, people here, they close the store because they go to have lunch. What the fuck? So I was kind of like, oh shit, maybe I should have stayed in the US, but the opportunity was in Spain. So we saw. When I was at Santander, Santander is the largest car financing bank in the world, and I knew a lot about car financing. So I saw Carvana and other players starting to sell cars online. With my co-founder, we identified an opportunity to create an online used car e-commerce site. So we started and since day one, I mean, we were very lucky to find product market fit very quick. So we started buying and selling cars online. We started in a little garage in Madrid that we're paying 700 euros per month. It was the cheapest place in Madrid for 7 euros a square meter. It was a very crappy place, but we were very happy. And I remember, so we started in November, and in January 1st, we sold the first car. It was a polo, a white polo. I was with my family, you know, in Spain on January 1st. And the customer calls me and I go right away to meet the customers. And so it was like a very nice experience knowing that we only made 400 euros with these cars, but on the first year we make 5 million euros. On the second year we made 14, on the third year 30, and then we went to 64, 250 and 500. So it was like a journey from zero to 500 million in revenues in 6 years. So it was quite a journey. But the most interesting thing is we're always profitable. So we're always EBITDA positive. And that helped us to raise very little money. We only raised 1 million as a seed round. And then we raised 4 million with a Series A in the first year. But then since year one to year six, the final exit, we didn't raise any money. We raised debt because we were profitable and we could get debt from banks from the car for car inventory. But that was the big learning, no? That it's possible to grow very fast while being profitable and minimizing dilution. Because when we sold the company, my co-founder and I, we own 70% of the business. So that's an advice I always give to founders, that it's possible to hyper grow without diluting yourself.
Now, what would you say that fueled that school of thought? Because obviously, at that point, I'm sure that now things have changed, obviously, with the macro environment on thinking about growth versus profit. But I'm pretty sure that those were the days too where it was growth above everything else. And when you have those numbers and that level of growth on the revenue side, you have VCs that are literally throwing money at you. So what do you think caused you guys to wanting to be laser focused and to not take more money from outsiders?
So one thing is being cheap. So I mean, we took the cheapest offices in Madrid. My co-founder and I, we didn't have salary until the exit. Even the travels we paid by ourselves. I mean, I think it's very important to make sure that every euro counts, that you have that culture, right? Because it's very difficult to change the culture. So you have a profitable mindset. It's very important to have this from day one. Then going from hyper growth and losses to profitability is super hard. So that's the first thing, is culture, that every count, every euro and every dollar matters since day one. And the other thing, it's about having control in your company. Because I was seed investor before being entrepreneur, and I've seen many entrepreneurs raising like a lot of money. And then one day they wake up only less than 10% of the company and being in a room surrounded by 10 guys who are head of VCs, but they are not operators, entrepreneurs. They don't understand the business and you lose control of your company, right? So we didn't want to lose control of our company. We wanted to control our destiny. And we decided that being profitable was the way to go to guarantee that independence. That it also gives you like a dual path optionality. If you start the VC, you get into a trap of racing, and then someone buying you. But when you are generating cash flow, you have a lot of optionality. You could keep the business for long term. You could go private equity. You could go get debt financing. So you have more options and you control your freedom.
So the company, you guys ended up selling it for a reported amount of 100 million plus, which is absolutely incredible. First company, first exit, and also a big exit. So make us insiders, you know, here. You know, what drove that decision to get acquired? Because I mean, you guys were doing great, incredible revenue. I mean, at what point were you guys like, okay, I think it's time to go after this acquisition?
Exactly. So when we got the offer, we checked with our friends entrepreneurs what to do, right? Because I think the rationale was, look, this is our first company, and this is a life changing event for us financially and reputationally. So, of course, we could keep the company growing and maybe bring it to a $1 billion valuation. But for us was like, look, you never know when we're going to have an offer. So it was good enough for us to. And in my case, I have other ideas to keep to keep starting other companies. So I said, look, with my co-founders, we decided let's sell this company. And then with the money, we can create more companies. We can be financially secure. And that's what I give the advice to many founders. Like the first exit is very important. And particularly in Spain. I mean, right now in Spain, we have like 13 unicorns. But at that time, There was no unicorns. It was not in Spain getting like $100 million offer in cash at that moment. It's not something normal. So we decided to accept, hopefully, because then most of our competitors were looking at Cazoo, Kava, all these guys were worth like $8 billion. But now some of them are bankrupt or disappeared, no? So you never know, right, about it. But we decided to accept and then move on.
What kind of reflections do you typically do when you go through an exit, you know, through a life-changing event, you know, especially when it comes to the financial side, because this gives you, you know, without a doubt, financial freedom. As you were saying, you guys owned 70% of the business, the co-founder. So what kind of reflections, you know, and thought process do you give to yourself and to what could be the next chapter when you go through a, you know, changing event like that?
Yeah. So in our case, we're happy to be part of Endeavor. It's an organization with 2,500 entrepreneurs globally, and I am a member of the board in Spain. So we talk to many entrepreneurs who have sold their businesses for life. And everybody was telling us the same, like, you have a unique opportunity to think about what's next. It was funny. Sam told me, I mean, don't change your card or change your wife. And the other thing, like, well, was wife, car and house, no, or something like this. No, so like, don't become crazy, like reflect about it financially. But the most important thing is like, sometimes when you are an entrepreneur, you're always like not having time to think, right? You're just executing towards the exit or towards the mandate from your investors. But this is a moment in your life. This is like, hey, look, in my case, for example, I have like a pressure to keep delivering. Like I've always been trying to have success professionally. And everybody was asking me, okay, what's next, Pablo? What's the next startup? And I was feeling like a lot of pressure. And one founder told me, look, don't be pressured. Yes, it's okay not to do nothing. It's okay to reflect. It's okay to... So what I learned is that the most important is not what you do after the exit, but do the things for the right reasons, right? Do the things because you like it, because you want to do it. So you earn the right to do what you want, not what other people want, not what the investors or the VCs. So obviously the VCs were telling me, okay, Pablo, thank you for the returns. Here you have like you want 10 million, you want 10 million, let's go to the next one. No? So I was feeling like a lot of pressure on that one, but I decided not to get that pressure. And then, okay, whatever I do it because I want to do it and not because other people tell me, right?
So as the saying goes, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And the next one, you know, the next opportunity that came knocking, you know, for you was Clicalia. So why did you think that the model of Clicalia was meaningful enough, you know, for you to take action, you know, on this opportunity?
Yeah, well, it was Clicalia. It was funded by my best friend, Alistair, and I, right after we sold Clicars. And the funny story is like Alistair was supposed to be a founder in Clicars, but we didn't convince him at that time. But when we sold the company, say, okay, now it's time for you to leave Santander Bank and start the company. So for me, it was like doing this with my best friend and with all the learnings that I have from the first experience, right? And the thing was like, okay, let's dream bigger. Like in our first business, we sell for that amount, but because it was like the first business. But that one we said, look, let's do something super big. Let's not settle. Let's not have an exit horizon. This is going to be something super big and we are going to enjoy it. We both love real estate, and in that we decided to start Clicalia, that is a real estate transactional where we are selling around 1,600 houses per year, 240 million in revenues in four countries with 1,500 people. And in that case, so we started with our own money, the first million, but then buying houses was a little bit more expensive than buying cars. So we raised a Series A of 12, a Series B of 60, and a Series C of 100 million, and then a 400 million debt financing. So 600 million in total in capital, 200 in equity, 400 in debt. But with the investors that we like it, that we want, and with the right space, And we decided to run the company with our own culture, with this. So I think when you are like a second time entrepreneur, I think you feel like it's not more relaxed because you're always working, but you feel like more that you are doing things for the right reasons. No, so we felt like in this one, Alistair also was a big investor in Clicar, so he make also like a lot of money. So we were like, look, we're doing this because it's what we want to do, and we're onboarding investors, but investors that will be happy to see in the board meetings and will be happy to have dinner with them. Because sometimes that's the problem, no? When you pick up co-founders or team members or investors that you don't like, you're fucked, no? Because you are going to see them every single morning. And we decided, look, if we are going to do this, we don't need the money. We're doing this for fun and because of our ambitions and we're going to create something big. Let's do with the people that we like to see every day.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And talking about people, you know, I know how when it comes to culture and team, you know, one of the things that that you are a big fan of is really mentoring and coaching folks as opposed to hiring outsiders. So walk us through this. Like, what are some of the key essence or key ingredients for having that mentorship and that coaching and developing people internally, you know, become a successful initiative?
Well, first I have to say, and there's no secret, and you just learn by mistakes, and 50% of the hires of the people that you want, they're going to promote, it fails, right? But for me, for Alistair and I, has been very important, both in Clicars and Clicalia, was to say, look, let's identify the people that have the right values, the right culture. And also, if you want to be EBITDA positive, you cannot pay super executive salaries, right? So you have to pay smaller salaries. So we decided to hire people that were a little bit younger and less experienced, but we held them to growth. Of course, at the end, when like around 50% of the executives we hire, 50% of the executives we promote, because it's impossible to promote all the people. But we saw many mistakes in many startups that were hiring like the superstars coming from Google, from Uber, with six-figure salaries, a crazy amounts. And these people didn't came with the right culture, right? And culture is very important in your executives, no? So I think that's something that that I'm very proud. For example, in Clicars, even a few years after the exit, the CEO is the one that we put there. All the executive management team, they remain there. They're the same people with the same culture. So I think that's important. Sometimes the speed of the business doesn't allow to be, people don't grow as fast as the business and you need to hire. But when you hire, look at culture. And for us, culture was like humility, thinking about profitable mindset, and have the ability. But having said that, I mean, I've made a lot of mistakes. And whenever you make a mistake, you have to be fast, right? In firing the executive that doesn't work, right? Or that doesn't have the right culture.
And how have you done it too, Pablo? You know, of being part of, you know, in this case, you know, we're now on the second company, you know, two fantastic success stories. But for you also to grow at the same speed as the company, how did you go about that?
Yeah, that's very important. So in the first company, I was the CEO. In the second company with Alistair, we decided that he was going to be the CEO. I was president, more helping him on managing the board, the investors, and the learnings from Clicar. So I think what's important is deciding what's your role, no? And sometimes you need to stop being CEO or to jump into another type of roles. And at the end, the most important thing is what's best for the business. So the other thing is scaling up yourself. So you could be like a good CEO of a 50 people company, but when it was to 1,000, maybe you are not good. So for me, what works is like talking to other entrepreneurs that have been there before. For example, in our cap table at Clicalia, we have Guillaume Posat, that is the founder and CEO of Checkout, right? Big success. And or people like Sergio Furio, the founder of Creditas. So we're calling, okay, how is about raising a Series C of 100 million? How is about talking to SoftBank? How is about hiring 1,000 people? I think it's amazing to be surrounded yourself with seasoned entrepreneurs that have been there before, and they can tell you your whenever you have a problem, you can pick up the phone and call them, and they are going to tell what they did, what they learned. And that's the other thing I would say is being very honest with your co-founder, talking about your weakness, your gaps, things that that you don't know how to do it. And also understanding what you like or you don't like. For example, in my case, I love bringing a company from maybe 0 to 100 million, but then when you have like 100 million in revenues or 500 people, 1,000, for me, it becomes more like a corporation. And I miss that thrill. So you need to know how good you are, but also what you like or you don't like. And be honest about it, to take measures like putting another CEO or moving on to another project.
So talking about moving on to another project, a year ago, you decided to turn page. What happened?
Yes, no. So I was missing the energy of day one, no, and that one. And with the experience that I have with Clicar selling cars, and my experience in Santander financing cars, I decided to start my third company. It's a ClearDrive. It's a car financing platform where people that own a car can get a credit line with their car. So it's a brokerage marketplace with banks and car owners, where car owners can get money for that. So I have this idea, but on this third time, I decided to do it differently. I said, look, this time, I really want to own 100% of the business, right? Because in both previous companies, we raise money and we have outside investors. And I always felt like a pleasure of I'm managing other people's money. So it's not my company, it's not my money. But in this one, I wanted to really have a sense of ownership. So in this case, what I did is like I bootstrapped the company. I put a few million euros from my own money. And so far, it's been 1 year. It went from 0 to 100 million revenues, positive EBITDA. Not a lot of people, like I have like 50 people. But thinking about long term, right? So I was thinking, how can I create a business that can be like a billion-dollar business, but in which I own 100% of the business in 10 years, right? Maybe not in 5 years, but without raising money. And that's the challenge. And I don't have pressure of managing other people's monies. I don't have banking debt. And for me, that gives me like a lot of freedom and flexibility and a peace of mind to run a business as you like.
Now, in parallel, you were also doing ClearBrain. So, you know, you decided not to go at it once, but twice at the same time, you know, as the next chapter.
Exactly. That was a mistake. I joke with many entrepreneurs that I decided to have twins voluntarily. No, so, I mean, I wouldn't have done it. I would have never done it again if I could come back, because I mean, one of the problems when you start business is that I am over optimistic, so you forget about the pain of starting the business, right? So and it never gets easier. Like you it's like you think, oh, it's the third time it's going to be easier. No, it's more difficult. Maybe you have more relaxed financially, or you know, you have more know-how, but it's always very difficult. But I was over optimistic, and I said, okay, I'm going to start the fourth business. So Clearbrain is an artificial intelligence company, helping companies to turn the unstructured data into ready to use data for being used with the public LLMs. And it's a very small company. We're only 8 people. I'm just I put $2 million of my money in this company, and I am the majority shareholders. And I and with my rest of the co-founders and the team, I gave them like a lot of equity. And we are bootstrapping the company, still not external funding. But in this case, I am not operational. I don't have an executive role. I just put the money and gather the team. And it was also for me to get inside of an exciting industry, artificial intelligence, that it helped me also with Picalia or with my investment strategy. But I think that the big lesson is that serial entrepreneurs, we always underestimate the pain and effort that takes starting a business from scratch, right?
Now, talking about underestimating the pain and effort, you know, for the people that are listening, you have quite an amazing hobby, and that is swimming in the open seas. So what is this? Tell us about this, because you have several records there that you've been able to break. And how have you been able to adapt, you know, that experience or those learnings from that into the world of entrepreneurship and the pain that you go through as an entrepreneur as well?
Yeah. So, well, the story is my father was a professional soccer player, so I have a good genetics. And but when I was 7 years old, I have an injury in my knees, and the doctors told me during 1 year you can only swim, you cannot do anything else. I was like super unhappy, but then I went to the pool and they discovered that I was very qualified. So I was very competitive, a long distance swimming. And I started to do all the crossings around the world, like the Strait of Gibraltar, Manhattan Island, English Channel, I mean, all these channels. And then at some point I decided to go farther. So I became the fastest person to swim 100 kilometers in the ocean. I did the fastest distance in the longest distance in 24 hours, both in the ocean, in a swimming pool, 36 hours continue swimming in a pool. And then my biggest record, that is the longest distance in the ocean, 250 kilometers from Miami Beach to Cape Canaveral in 2021. And the funny thing is that I was doing these records while I was building Clicars and Clicalia. And the funniest thing is like I couldn't go to the pool, so I put the pool in the company. So I installed a counter current pool in the car's factory. So all the mechanics were working on the cars there in the factory, and it was like swimming at 6 a.m. in the morning. But for me, being a competitive athlete, it helped me to be a competitive entrepreneur, because I always think it's important. As an entrepreneur, sometimes you are overwhelmed with work, and you don't exercise, don't eat well, and you have burnout. So in my case, a sport gave me like a way to escape from my stress entrepreneurial life, and thinking about that. Obviously, the trick is I am not married, I don't have kids, so I was waking up every day at 5:15, I'm going to the pool from 6 to 9, and then working at Clicars and Clicalia until late. So it was very disciplined, but it really helped me to have this disciplined mindset to that. And the funny thing is that I implemented the analytical mindset to swimming. So I put like cameras into the pool, and I was using a visualization to improve my stroke with analytics. I was very, very, I put a lot of effort on that.
But mindset, Pablo, you know, is something that you were alluding to earlier that I think is key. Because you were talking about doing 100 kilometers, swimming nonstop for 36 hours. you know, your mind, you know, I'm sure that in many instances there was telling you to give up. You know, you probably started hearing the voices of, hey, you know, I'm tired, I'm not feeling good, or this happened, you know, maybe I give up. How do you deal with those voices? And especially, like, were you able to shift, you know, that way of dealing with those voices and with your mindset, as maybe you're dealing with, like, challenging events with the business where maybe you're running out of money, or maybe, you know, like, there's someone quitting, or whatever fire that you have to deal with, where you're also having those voices and questioning yourself?
Yeah. So obviously we all have these voices and these question marks, both in the business and the sport life. I remember in the 250 kilometers at night, I was attacked by many jellyfish. I saw, like, a gray that it looks like a shark, and I was cold, and I was like, what the fuck I'm doing here in the middle of the ocean risking my life. But then for me, what works is, like, okay, don't think, dream big, but think and act small. Meaning, okay, put a big dream, but if you are in the middle of the ocean, don't think about the 1600 strokes that I have to give that day. I mean, think about one stroke at a time. Okay. I can do, like, I was counting the strokes. Like, I can do, like, 100 strokes. Okay. Then another 100. I can go to the next meal cycle in 1 hour. I can wait until the sunrise. So divide the big problems into a small milestones, right? Even when you are, like, in a company, like when we raise our Series A, for example, we're looking at, sometimes when you have, like, issues in the company, break down the problems into small problems. Like, okay, think about the next day, think about the next meeting, think about the next client. And that was really helped me, you know, dream big, but think and act small. And then at some moment, you stop, you look at the watch, it's like, oh shit, 36 hours, 150 kilometers, what just happened? And something that my family, they gave me some values of not believing, I mean, knowing that what you do is not because of you, it's because you are lucky, or because the people around you helps you. So not believing that your success is because of you, but just focus on what you can control. That is one stroke at a time, one client at a time, one day thinking about the day, and that's it.
I want to put you into a time machine, Pablo, and I want to bring you into the past. Okay, I'm bringing you into a time machine now, bringing you back in time. I'm bringing you back in time to perhaps, you know, that moment where you were still, you know, at Santander, you know, maybe like in 2015, right? Let's say I bring you back to that moment where you're now thinking about giving your notice. You're thinking about venturing into the unknown, jumping off the cliff, not knowing what you have in front of you. Let's say you're able to stop that younger Pablo on the tracks, that younger Pablo that is coming out of the Santander office, ready to become an entrepreneur, and you're able to sit down that younger Pablo right there on the spot and being able to give that younger Pablo one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Okay, so I would tell them, don't rush, be patient. I mean, building a business is not about creating a unicorn in 3 years. I mean, it takes probably 10 to 15 years to create, like, a great business, so be patient. Second, if possible, do not raise money. Keep 100% of the business, or at least a big percentage of the business, and try to focus on clients. Even if you grow a little bit less at the beginning, but try to not focus on funding, but focus on customers. No, make your customers your venture capital and your capital provider. No? And third is, like, don't take things so easy. I mean, at the beginning, everything is like a fire, right? Everything is like, and you are super stressed. So try to be happy managing problems and managing stress and enjoy your life, because as an entrepreneur, all your life is going to be ups and downs, super stress. So enjoy the journey, because you never know the outcome. It depends, like, a lot of things, your co-founder, product market risk, dynamics, financing, economics, whatever, competition. So you don't control the outcome that everybody wants, that is create a very valuable company, but at least enjoy the journey. And enjoying the journey is, like, relax, don't take things so seriously, and just focus on doing the right things every day, and have a patience, long time horizon, and look at the cash flow. Don't mislead yourselves with vanity KPIs. And at the end of the day, cash flow is key, and making sure that cash flow and customer satisfaction are the two things that you should focus
on. I love it. So, Pablo, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, you can reach me out in LinkedIn or through my email, pablo@pablofernandez.com. If you want to invest, I have invested in more than 100 startups. I love to share ideas. So happy to connect in social networks. And thank you for having me, Alejandro.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today, Pablo. It has been, without a doubt, an honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.